görgenin
yes in fact Rambam, he says, imagine a person who's already done one is accursed.
If Ganem is a way of cleaning himself for Gan Eden, you know what? If I'm trying to end the hell of a
some classical questions, and I also want to try to clarify the concepts a little bit. I say a little bit, I'm not joking. Freedom and responsibility are two concepts that are very hotly contested in contemporary philosophy, and whatever I say, there'll be a sizable number of philosophers against it. And indeed, whatever they say, there's a sizable number of philosophers against it, because the field is fraught with confusion. But I'm going to try to clarify some things, at least from my point of view, and hope that that will help. Let's start with what seems to be a contradiction. This is raised here in my shiurim from time to time, spontaneously by the students. On the one hand, we are told that we have free will. It's an axiom, it's one of the most fundamental principles of the Torah, that we have free will. The Torah says, I have set before you good and evil, life and death, choose life. Somebody tells you choose, that implies that you have the power to choose. So it seems that we definitely, according to the Torah, we definitely have the power for choice. On the other hand, there are 613 commandments. And it is clearly expected that we are going to do those commandments, or at least that we ought to do those commandments. That's certainly the right thing to do. The system is telling us what it is you must do. You might notice that I'm weaseling around with the words. I keep using different words. That's just to set the trap. Now, how can that be? Do I really have free will to make my own choices, set my own path, create my own priorities? If the same system that tells me I have free will also tells me that there's a comprehensive set of laws which dictate what I must do, what then happens to my freedom? How can I really be called free if I have everything dictated to me what I must do? That's good, huh? Real juicy contradiction. Boy, we caught those fruities. Let's go out and get cheeseburgers. There's a contradiction at the heart of the system. Now, there's an answer to this question, as you may have guessed. And the answer is to define very carefully what we mean by freedom, what we don't mean by freedom. In fact, there are two different concepts of freedom, one of which we do mean and one of which we don't mean. It's very important to make sure that we distinguish them when we talk and think about freedom and be clear what it is we're talking about. One is the power of freedom. The power of freedom means that at least some of the time, I cause my own action. My action is not caused by something outside of me. I'm not, at least not always, manipulated, pushed, pulled, shoved, forced to act one way or another. The power of freedom means only that I have the power to act on my own, at least sometimes, without any external power causing me to act. That's one concept of freedom. The other concept of freedom is the concept of authority. I am free to choose what I want, and when I do so, nothing outside of me can criticize me, evaluate me, judge me, because in determining my own conduct, I'm the top of the tree. Nothing stands above me and can tell me that what I did was right or wrong, good or evil, outside of me. This is a concept of authority. That when I decide it, I make it right for me. And nothing beyond me can override, overrule the correctness of my decision. So there are two concepts here. One is the concept of power. You can think of it as a physical concept. I do it. At least sometimes I do it. I'm not pushed around by something outside of me. And the other is a moral concept. When I judge it, it becomes right for me because I said so. Nothing outside of me can judge, criticize, evaluate my decisions for me. Is the difference between the two of them clear? Okay, now let's see how they fit. God gives us commandments, and we are expected to fulfill them, and we are supposed to acknowledge that it's right to do what he says. Let's take each of the concepts of freedom and see how they compare with the existence of divine commandments. Let's take power. On the one hand, God tells me what I ought to do. That's what I ought to do. That's what's right to do. On the other hand, I have the power to choose on my own. At least sometimes, nothing pushes me, forces me, manipulates me. I make my own choice in fact. Is there any contradiction between those two concepts? That's it. What's the contradiction?
First one is you. Second one said that you can do what you want a little bit.
Can, meaning?
That you decide whether it's right or wrong.
Meaning I have the
choice.
Power. Power. Choice is the word that has two meanings. Can is the word that has two meanings. Power is the word that has only one meaning. That's why I keep using the word power. This concept is the power. I have the power to choose. Okay. Now the other concept is God's commandments dictate what it is right to choose.
He has
the power to?
To tell you what's right and what's wrong.
To tell me what's right and what's wrong? He has the power, let's say, although Google questioned this in the latest year, the power to make it right, to make it wrong, does that take away from me the power to choose? No, it doesn't. Because even if something determines what's right and what's wrong, I have the power to choose what's wrong. The fact that someone determines what's right and what's wrong doesn't take away from me the power to choose, because, as we all know from our own experience and the experience of others, we sometimes choose what's wrong knowing it's wrong. Here's an example. You're in the army, and the commanding officer says to you, I order you to shut the door. Do you have free will?
Yes.
Of course you do. Soldiers disobey orders a lot of the time. They certainly have the power. The fact that the commanding officer orders you to shut the door doesn't take away from you the power to choose how to act. He makes it an order, and it could be that it's a valid order. Nothing you can do can invalidate the order. He's well within his rights to order you to shut the door. Still, you have the power to choose to say no. So if by free will we mean the power to act, then God's commandments, determining what it's right to do, what's wrong to do, don't take away my power to act. There's no contradiction there at all. You with me so far? Here there's no problem. If you go to the other concept of free will, there is a problem. The other concept of free will is that I am the one who determines what is right and what is wrong for me. No one can criticize my decision. No one can debate my decision. No one can evaluate my decision from the outside. It's impossible to say from the outside that my decision is wrong. Clearly, if God gives commandments, and his commandments are right, then a person's decision can be wrong. If his decision contradicts the commandment, then it's wrong. There is an authority outside of the person, higher than the person, from which he can be criticized. He is not the top of the chain. His decision is not right for him because he made it. So here there's going to be a contradiction. A contradiction between the authority of freedom, where I, with my freedom, determine what's right for me, versus God's commandment determining what's right for me. That really is a contradiction. And there, not both of them can be correct. You with me? Okay, now, that should be obvious at this point. Judaism says we have freedom, we have the power of freedom. Judaism does not say we have the authority of freedom. When the Torah says we have free will, it means we have the power to choose on our own, at least some of the time. We choose on our own, and nothing pushes us or forces us to act one way or another. Judaism also says that God's commandments determine what it is right to choose. No contradiction there. There would only be a contradiction if you moved to free the authority of freedom, where my decision makes it right for me. It can't be criticized from the outside. That indeed would be a contradiction to divine commandments. We don't accept that concept of freedom. That a person has the authority to determine for himself what's right and what's wrong. So, in terms of what the Torah affirms, there is no contradiction. Questions up to here? Everybody's with me. Okay, now,
well, it's just that we face more than just mitzvahs as things that could limit our freedom of choice in this world, right? I mean, that's not the only thing that limits our, that could be considered a limit on our freedom.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering now about one question. Is there a contradiction in two propositions the Torah supports?
Okay.
The Torah says that we have freedom, and the Torah says God's commandments determine what we ought to do. And given the kind of freedom the Torah asserts, namely the power of freedom, no contradiction.
I don't disagree with that. I'm just wondering if there are other things that...
Yeah. Freedom's a big subject. We'll get to other aspects at a time. This point, I want to explore each of the concepts of freedom in a second. Yeah.
The Torah, in that section, seems to imply that we have freedom, but aren't there one or more allusions in the Talmud about that our freedom's really limited, that God, everything's really in God's control, except for, like, Kol Mishamayim Chutz Me'Yirat Shamayim, or something?
Yeah, okay, we'll talk about it. But again, like he said, there are other factors that have to be taken into account in dealing with freedom. In fact, tomorrow, we're starting a series on freedom, and I will talk about that. Tonight, I'm only concerned about a couple of limited options. Now, let's look at these concepts of freedom in a little more detail. Let's take this idea of the authority of freedom. Not only does the Torah reject it, but I think we ought to reject it. I think philosophically we ought to reject it. The idea that nothing can criticize my choice. Nothing can evaluate my choice. I stand at the top of the chain. If I make a choice, it's right for me, period. I think that is a very inaccurate picture of the way in which choices are made and the way in which choices are evaluated. I'm going to give you some examples. Let's suppose that a person has chosen to work for a certain goal. And he's working for it, investing in it. Suppose we happen to know that that goal is impossible. It's simply that something is impossible to do. There's a law of nature against it, or it's mathematically impossible. He just doesn't happen to know this. This is not just a fantasy. Every editor of a scientific journal receives dozens of papers every year attempting to do something which is known to be impossible. It's just that the author doesn't know it's impossible. He's trying to square the circle or trifect the angle or build a machine that doesn't use any energy or, you know. There are hundreds of these every year. It's just that these things happen to be impossible. Isn't it correct to say that this person has made a wrong choice? He thinks it's right. He's happy with it. But in fact, it's a mistake. Because he has chosen to try to achieve something which is in fact impossible. Aren't his efforts wasted? Wouldn't he himself admit that the choice was wrong if he came to know that it was impossible? He's just ignorant. He doesn't know that it's impossible. Can't we, sitting outside him, look at him in sympathy and concern and pity and say, what a waste. He's trying to accomplish X and we know it's impossible to accomplish it.
Is that kind of like saying, well, you know, because they say you can never, the Torah is infinite. So are you trying to say, like, that even though his efforts will never accomplish finishing Torah, I mean, because it never ends. So, I mean, I wouldn't tell them that his efforts are worthless.
Okay. Now, here's a very important distinction. You put it that way. Other people put it in secular terms as follows. But isn't there value in pursuing the goal? Won't he achieve a lot just in pursuing that impossible goal? Of course, it depends upon what kind of impossible goal it is. If he's trying to square the circle, he's really wasting his time. He's not going to do anything. Nothing's going to come out of it. But if he tries to build more and more efficient engines, trying to get to the engine that uses no energy, you know, it might really do something worthwhile. But then, it would be even more appropriate for him to say, I'm not trying to do the impossible thing. I'm trying to get as close to the impossible thing as it is possible to get. And then indeed he has all the benefit, and the goal is the goal that really is the goal that will benefit him. But if he's really trying to do the impossible thing, then that part of it, which is dedicated to that, to the impossible thing, is incorrect. You don't cheat, you don't set yourself an impossible goal, because then you're wasting your efforts. Yeah?
He's not trying to do the impossible thing, he's trying to do the improbable thing.
That's all right. I'm talking about impossible though. Now, for example, take his example. Master the whole of the Torah. But the Torah is of infinite depth. So it is inconceivable to master the whole of the Torah. But if he's really setting himself to master the whole of the Torah, he has an inappropriate goal. If he says, I want to master as much of the Torah as I'm able to master, that's fine, that's open-ended. And it'll push him as hard as he can go for as long as he lives. But taking the goal as something that's literally impossible is a mistake. Often it comes up this way. A person dedicates himself to two goals. Each goal is possible, but the two together are not possible. And he's not aware of that. he is, in a way, fooled by the fact that each one is possible separately. No, I don't think that's right. It doesn't say anywhere that he should try for something that's impossible. That subjects the person to a confusion of ideas. And I don't think we feel that confusion of ideas is something a person should willingly inflict on himself. A person should be clear-headed. A person should try to realize the situation as best as possible. But he can reach for something which he's never reached before. Because it really is open-ended how far we can grow. There's a difference between saying X is impossible versus saying X is impossible for me. Maybe X is possible, but not for me. That means I have to know for myself how far I can go. Very often we don't know how far we can go. If I think back where I was 30 years ago, I would never have been able to predict that I'd be where I am today. Then I don't know it's impossible. But in his case, to know all of the Torah, that's clearly impossible. We're talking about knowing God's mind. The person who sets himself to know all of the Torah is setting himself an impossible goal. That's not appropriate. You know very well what they mean. You know what they don't mean? They don't mean that they know Kol HaTorah Kulo. That's the way of speaking. Here's another example. Imagine this happening to you. You're 16. And you have a friend who's 22. And you say to him, you know what? I really want X. X is right, X is important, X is valuable, I'm going after X. And he says, you know something? We come from the same city, we went to the same school. When I was 16, I also wanted X. But I'm 22. I don't want it anymore. And you know what? I can predict, because we're so similar, we come from such a similar background, I can predict that when you're 22, you won't want it either. So you say, baloney, who says that you and I are the same? You know, give all the 16-year-old answers. And when you're 22, you come to see that indeed he was right. Look at that. When you're 22, you want Y. So you say to your friend, who's now 28, you're right, X wasn't worth it. Now I'm going after Y. Suppose he says, yeah, I understand that. Because when I was 22, I also wanted Y. After all, we went to the same college, major the same subject. I can understand exactly why you want Y. But when you're 28, you won't want it anymore. You'll know more, you'll experience more, you'll know more alternatives, you won't want it anymore. Baloney, I am I, you're you, no, but when you're 28, by golly, Y goes by the board. And you say, you can predict the next stage, you say to your friend, I'm 28, I want Z. He's now 34. And he says, you're right, when I was 28, I also wanted Z. After all, we both took jobs in the same law firm, and we know. But I can tell you that when you're 34, you're not going to want Z anymore. Get to 34, bang, Z is gone by the board. Say to your friend, you were so right. I don't want Z anymore, I want W. Your friend is now 40. And he says to you, you're right, when I was 34, I also wanted W. But I can tell you, when you get to be 40, you're not going to want it anymore. Now, tell me, at this point, do you have reason to trust him? He's gotten it right 3 times in a row. He seems to know you pretty well. He's been able to predict against your judgment 3 times in a row how you're going to feel 6 years later. Wouldn't you think, gosh, you know, he really knows me pretty well. And although now I'm 34, and right now I really want W, maybe I should think twice about investing in W, since he tells me that 6 years from now I'm not going to want it anymore. Here you could have evidence that he knows better than you what you will want. And then, it might be reasonable to rely on his judgment and say, although I do want W now, I shouldn't really invest in it because later I'll regret it, because later I won't want it anymore. So here, not only can he have evidence that you're making a mistake, but you can borrow his evidence by virtue of the fact that he taught you 3 times that you made a mistake. You can borrow his evidence and use his judgment to improve your own. therefore think that there's no reason to take this position that no one can criticize my judgments. That when I make a judgment for me, it's right for me automatically. Yeah, a question?
Isn't there a large value in learning for yourself? And there's something that, no matter how much you trust somebody, you need to experience it for yourself in order to grow as a person?
There is a large value in learning for yourself those matters of life which are not significant. But you better not do it with your health, or you might regret it forever. And you probably shouldn't do it with your education, because then you'll regret it for all the extra years that it takes you to make up the education you missed. And you better not do it with your money, sizable portions of your money, or you might regret it for a long time. So it's very important about how to ride a bicycle, and whether or not it's worth spending a month reading Don Quixote, and whether or not it's worth it to take a trip to the Indies. Yeah, those are fairly trivial areas of life where if you get it wrong, nothing serious is going to happen. But if you decide to create your own medical education, after 6 years, you're going to be profoundly disappointed. Number one, because you can't become a doctor. And number two, because you don't know things that you need to know. Because when you decided to create it, you were 19. How much experience did you have to create a medical education? So in the things that really count in life, we typically rely on the judgment of others, because our information, our experience is so limited that we don't have enough of our own background to go on. Yeah.
Maybe this answered up my question, but how about that that they're not the same, and even though he didn't have that opportunity, you know, he worked in the same law firm, but maybe because he's not the all-powerful, God is really running the show, even though he keeps on telling me and he's on the money the last 10 times, maybe I should still go for the shop, because maybe God will bring some opportunity my way that didn't come his way. If it was something detrimental, don't do it. But
this is a crucial remark here. This is crucial.
The personal aspect. Everyone's different. Yeah.
It's crucial. Well, two parts to your observation. Number one, everyone is different. And number two, isn't it still possible that things will come out differently? It's true that everyone's different. But how different? And different in what respect? How could there be a science of medicine? Isn't everybody's body unique? No two bodies are identical. So how could there be a science of medicine? How could there be a science of nutrition? How could there be a science of ballistics when every two missiles are different? The answer is, what the scientists do is they describe the things that you have in common. Of course, there are differences. They're not describing the differences. They're describing the things you have in common. Now, for this guy to get it right three times in a row, in spite of the differences, means that in spite of the differences, he's clued into the things that are the same, and he's able to use them to predict. That's the answer to the first question. The second question is still there. Isn't it true that maybe it will come out different? The answer is yes. And now I want to give you a caution. This I would have you, well, if we didn't believe, if it weren't that we were against tattooing, I would say tattoo it on your arm. Maybe is a throwaway. If somebody suggests to you, maybe it's different, you shouldn't pay any attention at all. Because maybe always works. Maybe there are leprechauns. Maybe. Maybe. Can you prove there are no leprechauns? Pixies, trolls, you know, Middle Earth, hobbits, Gandalf and company. Go prove it. Maybe is a throwaway. Always ask the guy that says maybe, do I have any positive reason to think so? Not just me. Now, when I make decisions in life, I don't make decisions in life on maybes. I make decisions on life on what I have reason to believe. Here's this company that's going down, and they're talking about bankruptcy, and maybe it'll do a turnaround, and the stock will go up 1,000%. Maybe. It has happened once in a trillion times. Is that a good reason to invest in the company? Probably not. Probably not. That was very good. Yeah, maybe. Exactly. There's this quack. I happen to be a diabetic. There are at least 400 quack remedies for diabetes. I get them in the mail and people come around and they're selling them and so forth and so on. Right? Maybe one of them really will discover a cure for diabetes. Maybe. I can't certify it could never happen. Is that a reason to use it? By the way, I have a trick that I play with these people. I tell them, I'm willing to use your cure on one condition. That you can, it's a double or nothing. A double or nothing bet. You give it to me for free. If it works, I pay you double. Everyone I tried that on refused it until he realized something's wrong. If he doesn't take it, then he doesn't really believe in it, right? Because this is a chance to make double. And then when they come back, I say, listen, you flubbed it. Sorry. One guy caught it too quickly for me to convict him, so I tried it and didn't work. So I didn't pay anything. But so maybe is not a good reason to do something. You have to have evidence. Now, this guy got it right three times in a row and never got it wrong. That's very good evidence he's getting it right again. Maybe he's wrong, and maybe there are leprechauns. Maybe he doesn't count.
Yeah. Is there a case for limited freedom of authority when it limited being for people who reach a certain amount of expertise and within their area of expertise?
Okay. This is a very important remark. What I'm really advocating, to put it exactly right, I'm advocating using expert judgment. The subject of another shiur, but I could put in some of it now, which would be important. When you have an important decision to make, how do you make it? Let's make the case neutral so you can get your mind into objective gear. You're making a decision about somebody else's life. Somebody lent you his car, or he didn't care of somebody's poodle, or you're a lawyer and you're making contracts for him, or you're somebody's doctor and you're deciding what kind of medicine he needs. How do you make your decision? Suppose you're an average doctor, and this is a case which you haven't seen before and is very rare. Would you trust your intuition or consult a specialist? You're going to be in trouble if you consult your intuition. And if there are specialists who are trained in this field, then you consult the specialist. What would you want somebody to do with your car, or your life, or your poodle? Wouldn't you want them to use the best information that's available? Now, he asks rightly, suppose you yourself are an expert. The answer to that question is a limited yes. Yes, in terms of expertise, but you have to be careful about your being so close to your own situation that you can't evaluate it objectively. In law, they say that a lawyer who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. And in England, they add, and he has an idiot for an employer. Which really comes to the same thing, right? Because he's both the employer and the client. And doctors do not treat themselves or their own families because they're too close to their own families to see them objectively. So if you're going to have trouble with judging your circumstances objectively, then indeed, even though you're an expert, you ought to go to somebody else. It's not going to be a problem. If you're an expert in auto mechanics and you're fixing your own car, nothing wrong with that. Okay? A third example. Let's suppose, again, this false idea that I'm the top of the chain. When I make a decision for me, it's right for me. When you make a decision for you, it's right for you. Each person's decisions are right for him without the possibility of conflict. I'm sorry, without the possibility of criticism or external evaluation or critique. Now, it seems, if we say that, we're not going to run into interpersonal trouble because I'm making my decisions for me and you're making your decisions for you. And it could be that what's right for me is not right for you.
Perhaps when you have to make the decision at the doctor, for the other person.
Well, that's, I wasn't going to come to that case, but that's an interesting case. What happens if the doctor has to make the decision for what's right for him? Interesting case. As we go on the side for a moment, I haven't thought of that case. It's an interesting case to think about. I'll come back to it in Yitzhak Shem. Here's the case I want. Suppose Reuven and I are partners in a business. We're partners in a business. Now it's a question what the business should do. The business has signed a contract, and there's a very clever way that we can make money by exploiting one of the clauses of the contract, which is absolutely clear to us that the other side didn't understand, because the truth is we didn't understand it either, until somebody pointed it out to us. So, it's legal, but it's not exactly ethical. What should we do? The question now is, what should we do? And I'm going to think about that question, and Reuven's going to think about that question. It's not what should I do, I'm not the business. It's not what your groom man do. He's not the business. The business is we. Now let's suppose I come to one conclusion and he comes to the other conclusion. What happens to the unassailable rightness of each person's decision? Somebody's got to be wrong here. So this idea that I'm the top of the chain and I'm the one who makes the decision and no one can criticize my decision from the outside is simply a mistake. It's a mistake philosophically. The Torah is against it, and philosophically it's an incompetent idea, and therefore we should be done with it. That's what I think about your case. But we have enough ammunition, I think, to wipe out the idea.
In that case, no one's going to question the medical specialist.
See, one aspect of your question is this. It could be the doctor's asking himself, what should I do for him? So it's right for me to do. Right? As doctor. What should I, as a doctor, do for him? So there it becomes personal. You can collapse it into the personal. Okay. Now let's go back to the other freedom idea and question that. The Torah says we have the power of freedom. To make our own decisions on our own, not be pushed around, at least not all the time. Sometimes there are external causes, we know that. But much of the time there is not external causes. People often ask, the Torah promises rewards for doing mitzvahs and threatens punishments for failing to do mitzvahs. Suppose you really believe that. Wouldn't that overwhelm you psychologically? Wouldn't that leave you in the state of a robot just out of fear of punishment and promise of reward? Isn't that a kind of external manipulation? An external coercion? How different is it from putting a gun to a person's head and telling him what to do? So wouldn't that deprive us of free will, take away our power? And if it means if you're a believing Jew, it's all over, because for every mitzvah there's a promise of reward, and every violation there's a promise of punishment. So that would mean that we really don't have free will. Or, to work it backwards, if you say you have free will, it means you don't really believe. That could be. People's belief might not be that solid, not that strong. But if you really believe, then your free will is going to disappear. And that's right. But in my description of it, I included a clause which shows that it's wrong. I threw it in there as a little pocket bomb, you know, to explode the idea. I gave it to you on a platter. What did I say? That shows you that the idea has to be wrong, yeah.
I think this might be it, also the way I look at it is that you, like, Bechart HaBachayim is like the freedom to choose the package, so you have a freedom of choice, but once you make a certain choice, then your freedoms are limited. Like I don't have a freedom to eat a cheeseburger right now because I've accepted the package. Let's say, for example, and that's the freedom. And there's lots of different things that are packaged in freedoms. So,
okay, that's a very important observation. Let me restructure the question. I don't want to get out of it that way. But you're right. You're right to put it that way. Let's say you hear from God himself. You don't have to choose to believe or not believe. You hear it from God himself. If you do the mitzvahs, you get these and these rewards. And if you violate the mitzvahs, you get these and these punishments. So it's not up for grabs to choose to believe it or not to believe it. That's given because you heard it directly. Now that you believe it, for sure, are you stuck? Is your free will stuck? Okay, let's say you don't have any faith. I think faith is a mistake. Good faith is a Christian concept. It's not a Jewish concept. We don't need it. But leave that out for the moment. Just take what I'm giving it to you now. Let's say he believes it for sure without any question whatsoever. Does that mean that he doesn't have freedom? What did I compare it to? I said it's just like a person who has a gun to his head.
He chose to believe it.
What about a person with a gun to his head?
He still has a free choice.
Because millions of people throughout history have chosen to die rather than do what the guy with the gun says to do. And it only be religious people now. but for political reasons, for moral reasons, they refuse to do what the guy with the gun says, and they die. So having a gun to your head, and here the good and the evil are right in front of you, and some of them are atheists, and that are hoping for a place in the world to come, that are hoping for rewards from God, and they still choose to do what's right by their life, even at the cost of their lives. Knowing, you know, let's say you're the 16th guy up, and they shot the first 15 right in front of your eyes, so there's no question in your mind, you're going to go also, just like the other 15. And yet you still can't choose. The threat of punishment and the promise of reward does not take away your free will, even when it's immediately in front of you, let alone when it's decades in the future, and the reward and punishment are so vague that you can't really appreciate them, then psychologically, you are free to act against the promises without any difficulty, with very little difficulty. Think to yourself, how often do people make conscious, deliberate choices against what they know will be good for them in this world? You don't study a week before the exam. You wait till the night before the exam, you're up all the whole night. You know it's wrong. You yourself have done it so many times, and you know that you didn't get the best grade. You do it the next time as well. And how many people smoke? Nobody in this room, thank God. But there are people out there who do smoke, knowing that it's wrong. And eat the wrong things and don't get any exercise and all the other things, which they know very well are bad for them. Don't go to the dentist. And they know they're bad. And they'll tell you they're bad. There's no question that they believe it's bad. And they still do it. So the fact that we are promised rewards and threatened with punishments does not take away our free will. Psychologically, we are still capable of making our own choices. Yeah, question.
What about the argument that human psychology needs, we can't handle the fact of not having a meaning, of not having a purpose in life, so we've adopted religion because we need that, so hence we really don't have free will to choose, because the human psyche needs to have this kind of bigger purpose.
I love these arguments. Yeah, these arguments are all one-sided. And the people who make them don't realize that the exact same argument is made by the other side, which shows that both arguments are worthless. The religious people say people reject religion because they can't stand so much meaning, they can't stand so much responsibility, they don't want to examine every action to see if they could have done it better, they don't want to feel the guilt of failure, and therefore they throw off religion so they can eat cheeseburgers and sleep with each other's wives and cheat at business and not feel bad. And there's a whole industry called psychology, which is designed to produce guilt reduction so that you can do terrible things and not feel guilty for them. The truth is that weak people will look for a crutch. And religion can be a crutch, and atheism can be a crutch for the different for the kind of weak person you're talking about. If the human psyche needed religion as an absolute psychological need, no one would ever abandon religion. And indeed, in the 20th century, a sizable number of very educated, sophisticated people have abandoned religion. And they've gloried in the fact that they live without a religious basis for meaning. And indeed, they are proud to assert that they face the world honestly and objectively and acknowledge that there is no meaning. So I think this hypothesis is just propaganda for short-sighted people who don't realize that there are weak people on all sides, and people who use ideas as crutches, and nothing to do with the validity of the ideas. Okay, now, I want to try to make one more point this evening, sort of in preparation for tomorrow. Freedom and responsibility. There is a great debate in philosophy whether you have to be free to be responsible. You have to be free to be responsible. If you aren't free, if you're being pushed around, if you're being manipulated, if some external power is forcing you to act, then you're clearly not free and you're not responsible. Here's how the thought goes. George is standing at the top of the stairs with his back to the, with his face to the stairs. Peter sneaks up behind him very quietly and gives him a shove. And George tumbles down the stairs. At the base of the landing of the stairs, there is a 5th century Ming vase. And George, weighing 200 pounds, smashes the vase to smithereens. Is George responsible for smashing the vase? Clearly not, because Peter pushed him. He didn't choose freely to smash the vase. He was just the tool with Peter's push. Of course not. Not when somebody pushes you.
What was he doing at the top of the stairs?
Waiting for a telephone call. But there was a
Peter responsible for the vase?
Can you put himself in there?
Probably Peter's responsible for the vase, because as far as the vase is concerned, George is like a club. Like Peter picking up a club and dropping it, rolling a rock down the stairs and hitting the vase.
Peter wasn't necessarily aiming for the vase, so pushed George down the stairs.
Okay. The foreseeable effects of a criminal action you're responsible for.
Who is
a person who doesn't tighten his brakes on his car and then hits the kid in the street. He didn't intend to hit the kid in the street. He couldn't predict, but he could foresee that such a thing could happen. He's responsible because he didn't tighten his brakes. And anyway, we're now considering every possible variation. I want to get through one point of freedom. Now a father case. George has a terrible smoking problem, and he goes to a hypnotist. And this hypnotist gives him post-hypnotic suggestions to help him stop smoking. Every Thursday night. One Thursday night, on a lark, the hypnotist says to George, next Monday morning at 10 a.m., your right arm is going to swing out in front of you like this. When I bring you out of the trance, you're not going to remember this, but at 10 a.m., Monday morning, wham, out goes your right arm. Good. George wakes up, pays his fee, says goodnight. Monday morning, he's visiting his friend Peter, and Peter is taking him for a tour of his antiquities. And at 9:59, Peter places George in front of the pedestal with the 5th century Ming vase, and is explaining the beauty and antiquity of the vase. And there's a grandfather clock in the corner that's chiming the hour. And at the 10th chime, George's arm swings out and smashes the vase. And Peter says, what are you doing? And George says, I don't know. I honestly don't know. It went by itself. You know, it just sort of went out. I didn't choose to do it. I didn't. It's the strangest thing. It's never happened to me before. I can't explain it. It just sort of went all by itself. Right? Is George responsible for smashing the vase?
No.
I think not. He didn't choose to smash it. He couldn't have predicted that he would smash it. He didn't want to smash it. Why should he be responsible?
He did it.
So what? And when he fell down the stairs, he also did it.
Mentally retarded kid hits something, is he responsible?
Of course not. He doesn't know what he's doing. When you'll have children, your children will smash a lot. I'm not cursing you. I'm just telling you a fact. You know, the children who sit in a high chair and they have food, they become great scientists. They experiment with gravity. What will happen when I drop it? And they watch it go. And it's very exciting. They watch the next one go. And the next one go. You know. One of my children is married to one of a set of quintuplets. And when they were young, the parents, in the middle of the night, heard a smashing sound downstairs. They come down to find that the quintuplets are sitting in front of the china closet. And here's what they're doing. The one is handing it to two, and two is handing it to three, three is handing it to four is handing it to five, and five is smashing it. Smashing all the dishes. It's great. What a sound it makes, you know. And they're smashing dish after dish. No, they're not responsible for that. They don't go to jail for that. You know, take off from their grandparents' bonds for that. You know, they were 4 years old. Right? Anyway, these are the real, you know, they say twins have a private language, and they have a special bond. Imagine quintuplets. They were a gang. One night they decided to move all the furniture upstairs. You know, all the chairs and the tables, they carried them all upstairs. Okay, anyway. So, you push down the stairs, you're not responsible. If it's a post-hypnotic suggestion, you're not responsible. Now, let's go to the extreme case. You have this adult human being walking around, doing things. Some people will tell you, they're called social scientists, if you can sort of tolerate the term, that everything you do is produced by a combination of your DNA and your environment. Your DNA sets your basic character, basic characteristics, and then the environment molds them in various ways, including the intrauterine environment before you are born. Fetuses learn before they're born. And of course, post-birth, family, society, schooling, economic class, the physical circumstances of your environment, topography, climate, so that when you get to be an adult, everything you do is fully determined, fully caused, fully produced, fully forced by the combination of the DNA and the environment. In other words, basically, you're a robot. Take into account the DNA and the environment, and you're a robot. Or to use somebody else's illustration, you are a bubble on the stream. And you're just carried along by the stream. You don't do anything on your own. Everything you do is produced by this set of factors outside of you, creating everything in you and manipulating everything in you to produce what you do. The thought now is that you have the same result. Why do I care whether the cause is immediate, Peter pushing down the stairs, George down the stairs, or the cause is 4 days earlier, Peter hypnotizing George and telling him what to do on Monday, or whether the cause stretches back to before my birth with my parents' DNA and works through the sum total of environment up to the very moment? What difference does it make? I'm being pushed around by something outside of me, and it's causing me to do what I do. In all those cases, this argument says, I'm not responsible for what I do. Because in none of those cases am I making a free choice. That's the thought that freedom is necessary for responsibility. If you're not free, you're not responsible. Yeah.
Well, if there's no not real good evidence for that claim, but if they're right about it, if there's some way of knowing that they were right, then that's probably a pretty good claim if they're right, just that they don't have any evidence.
I think what you mean is this. The proposition I'm considering now is an if A, then B proposition. If everything you do is produced by DNA and environment, then you're not responsible. What you're talking about is A. You're talking about whether or not everything we do is really produced by DNA and environment. Right, right. And I agree with you. There is no good evidence for that. I will probably talk. But I'm not interested now in A for itself. I just want to know that A is sufficient for B. Okay? Excuse me. If indeed that were true, and I agree with you, there isn't good evidence that's true, even though some social scientists will tell it to you, cognitive scientists will tell it to you, you're talking through their hats. If I have a chance tomorrow, I'll tell you why.
That's a cop-out.
Correct, correct. It's definitely a cop-out. But at any rate, if it were true, then we would be in serious trouble because it wouldn't be responsible. That, I think, is correct. Freedom is necessary for responsibility. If you aren't free, you aren't responsible for what you do.
It definitely has to be calm.
Freedom.
No, the environment. Like, if you're born yes. in a place you're clearly in, you're going to go out.
No question.
You're going to have morals with you, even if you're not correct.
There is no question that the environment has an influence. But influence is not total causation. That's why I said, you're forced, caused, determined to do what you do. Totally by the external cause. You're talking about influence. Influence definitely is there. But we're not talking about influence. We're talking about total causation. Yeah.
This is the right time and place. So how is it that happens that Hashem still knows what you're going to do?
Okay, no. That's another issue altogether. Knowledge is one thing and cause is another thing. Knowledge could be totally passive. God could know without doing anything. We'll talk about that against Hashem.
Is this time to bring up how there are cases in Judaism where you don't, where there's punishment without responsibility?
Yeah, they're not. It's not punishment, and it's not necessarily that responsibility. So, but that's not the place. That's a moral issue. I'm interested now just the relationship of freedom to responsibility. Now, I want you to know, there's a whole school of philosophy that disagrees with me. There's a whole school of philosophy that disagrees with me. And at the risk of boring you even more this evening, I would like just to tell you what they say, why they say it, and why they're wrong. Here's what they say.
David is right.
No. Not even maybe. I won't even give maybe. They're not even as good as leprechauns. Here's what they say. We'll show you, they say, that a completely determined creature, a creature that's a complete robot, still is responsible for what it does. Because why do we hold people responsible for what they do? It's, after all, is an activity. It's a social form. It's an institution that we all engage in, evaluating people's actions, praising them, blaming them, rewarding them, punishing them. Why do we do that? What's the point of doing that? These critics say the point of responsibility is to improve people's behavior. That's the good of it. That's the impact of it. So, if you praise someone, that's a little push, a little nudge that he should repeat it. If you criticize somebody, blame somebody, that's a little push, a little nudge that he shouldn't repeat it. That's what responsibility is all about. That's what it's for. Now they say, given that that's the purpose of responsibility, to affect people's behavior for the good, notice that responsibility can have this effect even for a robot. All you have to do is program the robot to be responsive to praise and blame, to reward and punishment. So, for example, there are learning programs which reevaluate their performance on the basis of the outcome. Chess learning programs. You know how they make Big Blue and those other things? They don't program in a super smart strategy. No one is smart enough to think up a super smart strategy. What you do is you program a very primitive strategy. And then you program a learning feedback program. You make this move and you lose the piece, make it less often. You make that move and win the piece, make it more often. Then you run 10 million games through the computer at high speed, and it learns from 10 million games. What are the best moves and what are the poorer moves? That's roughly how it's done. Now just imagine, you have this computer doing various things and producing various results, and it's programmed. When I type in, "very well done, computer," exclamation point, then it repeats that program more probably. And when I type in, "you dope, what a stupid thing to do," then it lowers the probability of that program. Won't my praise and blame affect the behavior of the computer? Of course it will. It's programmed to respond to that.
That won't work with the human.
Suppose that we are programmed by our environment to respond to praise and blame. We're just computers programmed to respond to praise and blame. When you say, "good boy," probability goes up. When you say, "bad boy," probability goes down. Would not responsibility play its same role, have its same use, have its same value? Even if we were robots, just assuming that we are robots, programmed to respond to being held responsible in that way.
The problem isn't with that argument, it's with what the purpose of holding people responsible is, which is not to improve people's behavior, but to mete out justice and to create, you know?
And they'll tell you the purpose of meting out justice is to improve people's behavior. Meting out justice means roughly you get what you deserve, you get what you've earned, you get what's yours by right. That certainly will encourage people to earn more and deserve more, because they'll get more.
And if you don't have someone to tell you what's right and what's wrong.
Good. Leave that on the side. We know what's right and what's wrong, and what the point of responsibility is to encourage people to act better. Yeah.
Well, one of the reasons that you need men to raise a crime, which is like the guilty mind, is because if you don't have the guilty mind, then you're not going to learn from being punished for something that you didn't know you did.
Correct. And therefore, that's exactly why they will tell you, that the concept of responsibility is such that it requires mens rea, because if it didn't, it wouldn't have the effect of improving his behavior.
Right, so it requires, so if we just punish the guy that fell down the stairs, then that didn't have the mens rea.
Correct.
Then he's not going to learn not to stand your stairs again because he didn't try to do it.
But they say that's support for them. That's support for them. After all, if the purpose of responsibility is to improve someone's behavior, you would expect built into responsibility is the condition where, if you apply it, it will realistically improve his behavior. And the reason that is built in is because the purpose of the institution is to improve his behavior.
But it won't improve his behavior.
Sure it will. According to our concept of responsibility, you don't punish him unless there's what you call mens rea, right? Why is that built into our concept of responsibility? Because punishing a person is supposed to improve behavior. Without mens rea, it won't improve behavior. So that's why our concept of responsibility requires mens rea, so that it will succeed in improving people's behavior. They build that in. It's evidence for them, not evidence against them.
But the whole thing is phony. It's so phony. Yeah?
Isn't there an assumption that people will respond to praise by improving their behavior?
Isn't it obvious that they do?
No, it's obvious that they don't. I mean, you so look at it this way.
I don't think
that's right. You commit a crime, you go to jail.
Yeah.
Most of the time, people go to jail. They're just a phenomenon of repeat offenders. They've been punished. Their behavior didn't get better. They're back in jail. Well,
they're not robots. And they're not praised. Yeah. They're not praised by anybody.
Are they praised in jail? They're punished by being in jail. What's the praise?
They're praised by the community. That's why they keep doing it. They're praised by
heroes to their communities. And especially to the communities of criminals. Then they come out, they don't get ostracized. They don't get degraded.
It's a bit of a crime. We're talking about.
Then you may have people
who are molesters.
Okay. But then they're talking about a very, very tiny select portion of people. And they may be like addicts, for all you know. But at any rate, there's something much more seriously wrong here. Okay, so what? You're right, but so what? How do you answer their claim? Their claim is the purpose of responsibility, justice, right and wrong, good and evil. All of it is to improve people's behavior. And we are telling you, you can improve people's behavior even if they're robots.
Because the next person who went and smashed it, and he had to take responsibility, and once another guy didn't, he'll just continue to do that. He can use other people to use them as pawns.
The correct answer here is that they're barking up the wrong tree altogether. Give them everything they said. Let it be true that the purpose of responsibility is to improve people's behavior. That says nothing about whether it's true. This is a pragmatic fallacy. Something can serve a purpose without being true. There are all sorts of falsehoods that serve purposes. Indeed, Plato suggested that the ideal city be built on a gigantic lie. That people's souls are made of different metals. And the metal in your soul determines what role you play in the city. That way people won't envy each other's roles in the city. Each person will be content with the position that he plays. It'll lead to cooperation and integration in the city. And Plato says, of course, this is a lie. But look at the tremendous value this lie has. What these critics are really doing is telling us that if we pretend that everyone's responsible, we'll get very good results. Let's agree to that. I don't mind. That wasn't the question. The question was not, is it valuable to pretend to be responsible? The question was, are we responsible or not? Their argument doesn't touch the issue in question. The examples of Peter and George are designed to show that if you don't make your own decision, you're not responsible, period. They say, but if we treat you as responsible, I put it in my terminology to make fun of it, if we pretend you're responsible, look at all the good that will come out of it. Correct. I agree. That doesn't say anything about whether you're really responsible. I must tell you, I struggled with this for years. My intuition told me that this is phony. I couldn't put my finger on it. A very excellent philosopher named Susan Wolfe, who was then at Harvard, I believe, wrote a paper on this a long time ago, maybe 15 years ago. And when she put, and I was very embarrassed because I taught pragmatism. And I know pragmatism. And I couldn't articulate where the failure lies, though I know the pragmatic fallacy. And she put it this way, I think she's 100% right. The failure here is confusing what it would be good to do and useful to do on the one hand with what's true. So what we are remain with is that freedom is necessary for responsibility. That if you're not free, if you don't make your own decision, you're not responsible for what happened with your body. I won't say what you did, because many people, I think they're right, say if you say he did it, that already implies he chose it. It didn't just happen to him.
And if you know he's going to do it.
If he knows he's going to do it?
No, you know he's going to do it. Should you hold him responsible?
It depends upon how I know. It may be that he has a tick. And I know that every now and then he, you know, jerks. So what? Does that make him responsible for it? Because I know he's going to jerk?
That's what I mean. There was a movie called Minority Report where somebody had this machine that could tell that people were going to do things in the future, crimes. So they lock them up before they would do it. Right. They had this machine that would just...
So then the person who's watching the machine is responsible. Not the guy who's doing it is responsible. The guy who's watching the machine and sees on the machine Smith is ready to commit murder. That guy who's watching the machine is responsible to stop Smith. Doesn't make Smith responsible for committing the murder. We're not responsible for committing the murder. Nothing to do with it.
Well, do you have a right to lock up Smith before he'll do it?
I would guess so. Don't you want to protect the victim?
Let's watch the movie and see what happens.
We have this queer idea. You know, we think only about the criminal. You know, rights of the criminal. We don't ever think about the victim. Excuse me, it's my wife. Let me just switch up. Hi. Hello. Yeah, hello. I'm teaching. Yeah. So where are we? Right? So in all the world, the difference between saying that it's useful and saying that it's true. And our position is that it's not true. If you're not free, you're not responsible. Therefore, freedom is very important. For us, it's very important. And if there is an attack on freedom, if there are those who believe that we're really not free, it's important for us to take it seriously and to see whether or not such an attack can be sustained. Social science is one sort of attack. God's free will, God's foreknowledge, that He knows before I do what I'm going to do, is such an attack. God's providence is such an attack. And we will consider those attacks tomorrow and the next day. Okay?